This is Nevin Campanella welcoming you to the BBS production of Woodland Star, your net radio source for entertainment and coincidental enlightenment. And we have a guest this afternoon. His name is Vincent C. Beach, a rather fascinating gentleman, originally from Jamaica, and he's going to tell us his story. He has a book out, and I'm going to leave it up to Vincent to discuss it. Let me say right off the top, quote, Vincent has seen a lot in the past 82 years, wars, fought peace, enjoyed peace, bigotry endured, and inclusion celebrated. Loves found and loves lost, children born and children buried. Through it all, his mother's adages have helped him sustain him. And now this is from his mother, folks. Quote, don't throw away your stick till you cross the river, she often told him. It was not until years later that he grasped the full meaning behind the saying. Now, I have absolutely no idea what that means. I have not yet spoken to Vincent. He is on the line, and I will get him on here in a few seconds. But first, I want to give you a toll-free number to call. Should you want to say hello, our toll-free number is 877-270-8714. Or you can call direct 530-413-4515. I'm getting a notation here from my production on the Brigham City side that says to tell Don the volume has got to go up a little bit. Okay, where do we begin? Let's get Vincent on the line. Vincent, are you there?
Yes.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Vincent, you live in Arizona, is that correct?
Yes, I live in Phoenix, Arizona.
The weather in Phoenix, Arizona, what's it like right now? Are you having a nice warm weather?
Yes, comfortably warm. Approximately about
warm.
Street.
I spent some time in Arizona around the Glendale area and also around Phoenix, and I can remember some really hot temperatures, especially around Phoenix.
Well, yes, it does. It's pretty hot.
Which right now, I'm very cold, so I wouldn't mind a little bit of that heat. Vincent, you came a long way from your early years living in Jamaica. Now, many of us have only information from travel companies about what life might be like in Jamaica. And the information that we get about Jamaica, of course, is always about, you know, travelers and vacationing and so on and so forth. Your life in Jamaica, as a black child growing up in Jamaica, was the real side of Jamaica. Tell us a little bit about what did life look like in Jamaica to you as a child?
Me as a child, Jamaica was a glorious place to live in. Because we had no cares. We go along with stuff that we have, and there is stuff that we do not have. We didn't worry about it. Most of what we have, we make do.
You make do. So life was hard for you growing up in Jamaica.
That was very hard. If you're thinking of...
Do you have brothers or sisters?
Yes, I had after recently. Most of that.
Do you still have family in Jamaica?
Yes, I have a sister still there.
Oh, and do you visit her or what at all?
Well, I visited her about 5 years ago, and she was doing quite well, though she's about 78 years old.
Oh, do you have any other family surviving?
Yes, I have a wife and two kids still remaining.
For the information for the audience, I simply want to mention that Jamaica is an island in the Greater Antilles, and it's situated in the Caribbean Sea. And folks, you have all seen the travel commercials about Jamaica, you know, the beautiful beaches and the trees and so on and so forth. But the Jamaica that Vincent remembers was not what you're seeing in the travel logs. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got to school in Jamaica? Back in the rural Jamaica in the late 20s, how did you get to school?
We walk. And we carry a slate board. That's what we write in schools. We weren't given papers that you can use and discard.
And you carried a slate with chalk. How did you keep things from washing away on it?
And you make sure you keep it secure, because it will wash away or condense away if it's left open. So therefore, you have to protect your writing material. Whatever you wrote would only last for one day, because we didn't have throwaway papers. And that's why.
It must have been extremely difficult. Vincent, you have written a book titled Don't Throw Your Stick Away Until You Have Crossed a River. What is the book about?
The book is an autobiography of myself and the children.
What made you want to write an autobiography?
Too often, too many of us pass on and never get to tell our children how it was.
Ah, I see. So you left a historical legacy in writing for them.
Exactly.
And wonderful. Maybe we should all follow that example, huh, Vincent? Every one of us kind of sit down and try to write an autobiography, although it would be hard. Listen, that's a very unusual title. Don't throw your stick away till you've crossed the river. What does that mean?
It means don't throw your stick away until you've crossed the river.
Yeah, I figured you tossed that one at me. But give us and the audience the analogy. In other words, how could you apply it to other parts of your life?
The fact is that opportunities come so few and far in between that when it comes, you don't discard it and just take it for granted. Whatever opportunity comes to you in life, you make sure that it is well used, especially in the time I spend with the Royal Air Force. Opportunities come, and once they're gone forever.
You're right, Vincent. Too many of us spend too much time thinking and not enough time doing. And what you're telling everybody is, when you hear that knock on the door, take advantage of it. Do it now.
Do it now.
And be careful of what you toss away. You may need it. And that might also go for relationships with people. You have in your book, you refer to your parents as Mass T and Miss Rosa. Why was that?
Well, that was an abbreviation for Master. And Miss Rosa, of course, that was my mother's name.
But why wouldn't you use Mother and Father or Mom and Dad, something less formal? Why was it so formal?
It was the way we did it at the time. I'm not sure there was an explanation for it. But it was the common practice.
Oh, okay. So everybody did that.
Everybody did that.
I see.
These abbreviated phrases.
In your book, it mentions that your childhood prepared you for the rigors of life you were about to face. And you knew that if you stayed in Jamaica, you would be denied the future you envisioned for yourself. So what is it about Jamaica that disallows personal growth? I mean, if you had stayed there, what would have stopped you from realizing your own vision?
It stopped you because the economic situation was so dire. It was not where each and every one of an economic start, as we do here in the United States. There were opportunities to go to, for instance, high school. There was not a chance for high school for the average kid because you must pay for high school. And how many of us could afford to pay for high school? Not very many.
There wasn't a whole lot of job opportunities for anyone in Jamaica. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, yes.
What kind of work did your father do?
My father was a part-time tailor, and he worked at the logwood factory. They make dye for this logwood.
And your mother stayed home?
Yes, she was there. Because they were six children.
There were six children?
Children to take care of.
Well, how old were you when you left Jamaica?
I was approximately 19.
Did you finish high school in Jamaica?
No, couldn't afford it.
Oh, you couldn't afford it, okay. How did you get out of Jamaica?
One day we visited the recruiting station. The RAF was recruiting in Jamaica because, remember, this was a wartime condition. And so young boys were invited to join the RAF. And that's how
You joined the RAF? Is that what you said?
Yes.
How did you get in touch with, the authorities of the RAF? Did they have something in Jamaica encouraging young boys to join?
They were actually recruiting. They were recruiting among young teenagers to live, to get a passage and go off to join the RAF.
What year was that you joined the RAF?
1944,
right in the middle of World War II.
Right.
And when you joined, where did you first go?
First place we went to, we sailed to New York. And from there, we went on to Scotland, England.
And how long were you in the Air Force?
Approximately 7 years.
Okay, tell us about what you did in the Royal Air Force. What kind of functions did you have? First of all, did you see combat?
Yes, actually. Crossing the Atlantic, that time of year, and that time and place was very, very dangerous.
And were you involved in the middle of any kind of shooting in the war?
Depth charges and so forth to counter submarine threats. We had many submarine threats going up to England during 1944.
How would you describe your role in the Air Force? What did you do on a day-to-day basis?
Day-to-day basis, get the landing strip prepared for aircraft landing or any other job that was necessary.
So then after 7 years of going through the war and the Royal Air Force, then what happened to you?
Then after the war, the RAF invited some of us to extend our service. And so I extend for another 4 years.
Okay, and you ended up in the United States. Where in the United States? I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
Yeah.
Well, I took advantage of the opportunity given by the RAF.
Nevin,
yeah.
Can you hear me? This is his wife, Annie.
Uh-huh.
And he's getting a little bit tired for a few minutes. He has a severe kind of Parkinson's, and I want to answer a couple of things that you have just asked him, if that's all right.
Well, listen, Annie, it's been pretty choppy up until now, and I understand he's having some difficulty.
Yes.
And so I'll tell you what I would like to do. Rather than putting the gentleman back on the air, which is extremely stressful for him, I can hear it in his voice.
Yes.
Why don't I conduct the interview with you as you know him, okay? You're most familiar with his work and what he's done.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's go back to, I kind of lost him in terms of the Royal Air Force. He spent 7 years there. In the Air Force. Now, he said that he was preparing runways for planes that might crash and so on and so forth. Was there anything else that went on? Did he ever see combat? That's the question I'm trying to get to.
Okay. The actual out there fighting, no. He prepared when he first, was on active duty, he was a works hand, they called it. And he prepared the runways. He worked around where the planes were coming in and out, the bombers, and that kind of thing. Yeah, and then after the war was over, even while the war was going on, he would inspect the vehicles that were coming in from the front, and then he would determine whether they were ready, to go back out or whether they had to be trashed. And he became a kind of a supervisor in that. He was beginning to show, the abilities that he had, even though he was very young. And that's what he did throughout the duration of the time until he got out of the Air Force, and the Royal Air Force. And that's the interesting part that then began to take place for him.
Well, when he got out of the Royal Air Force, he spent 7 years there. What did he do after he left the Air Force? Where did he go?
Okay, he stayed right there because that is when he had signed up again, he took his bonus money and he bought an old clarinet. He wanted to play jazz. That's what he had determined to do. He had no music background. He'd never played anything. But
now, you're talking about he stayed in England is what you're saying.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, for that
time.
Okay, so he got a clarinet, and even while he was still in the Air Force, he began just trying to teach himself and listen to the radio and Benny Goodman and all those guys back there. And that's what he determined. He wanted to be a jazz musician. So when he got out of the Air Force, he did not sign back up because he wanted to put everything, all his time into music. And so that's exactly what he did. He didn't even really work at a job. He had enough money saved up. He's a very good saver. and he had enough money saved up that he could just practice his music. And he and another buddy bought a house and then rented out rooms right there in London, and he practiced. And then he
So when it comes to jazz, he's completely self-taught.
Almost, yes, except what they did with each other. He had a teacher maybe once a month here or there, but between the clarinet and the saxophone, that's how they did.
How did he get attracted to that to begin with? I mean, he doesn't mention that at all in terms of his childhood music being around him. How does he all of a sudden get involved in, I want to play the clarinet and do jazz?
I think because other people were doing it, a lot of the black guys around London, that was a way that they saw that they could maybe make a life, was to become a musician.
Makes sense.
Charlie Parker was very popular at that time, and he followed his music, and it's just something that he wanted to do. But he had absolutely, the only thing he had had was with Mother Xavier in his little Catholic school, having him sing around the organ, the old-time songs. That was his extent of music.
Once he got involved with music, eventually he did immigrate to the United States, right?
Yes, he did.
Okay, what made him make the decision to immigrate to the United States?
Because all his buddies said that's where the jazz scene was. If he was going to really make his way in music, like with a big band, had to get to the United States.
Annie, we have a caller online. I happen to know who she is. It happens to be my wife. And she has read Vincent's book. I had told Vincent up front I wouldn't have the time, but she did read it, and she's got a couple of questions she'd like to ask. Jill, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Jill, why don't you ask the questions to Annie?
I did enjoy the book so much. I was curious about the fruit that tastes like eggs, because I love eggs and my husband's allergic. But I thought it was a very uplifting book, and it would be nice if more people would write that, even through the disappointments and devastation periods in your life, that you can rise above that, one step at a time, and to choose to be happy and just hang in there and make choices every day, every hour. So I really thank him, want to thank him for writing it.
He's listening to you.
It's a wonderful story, and that's why
it has to be told.
Yes. But it was very uplifting, and so many people get downtrodden with their disappointments and don't see what's around the corner because they're too busy looking at the past and what's happened to them and poor me kind of thing instead of struggling forward. And so I think that it was a wonderful, inspiring book, and thank you very much for writing it.
Jill, do you have any specific questions to ask Annie?
Yes, I was wondering if you still participated in the Jam Pack Band, if that was still active.
Three times a week. We just played last weekend for the Tucson Bluegrass Festival.
Are you telling me that Vincent is still playing the clarinet?
No, he doesn't play. He plays with the violin. He plays strings in the bluegrass because you can't have those other things in traditional bluegrass.
So he's still very active with music, is what you're saying.
Oh, yes. Yes, we just got done playing at church today, and he plays the tambourine there. But his airflow is not such that he can sustain. He can still pick up and play the saxophone, the flute, and the clarinet. But to play a lot, a whole gig, his air flow is not strong. That's one of the problems, Parkinson's.
Jill, I want to thank you for calling in. And I'm glad you read the book.
Be sure to ask her about the National Excellence in Parenting Award that they received.
Well, ask her.
I thought that was very impressive.
What award was that?
Your National Excellence in Parenting Award.
Yes.
That must have been very exciting.
It was extremely exciting and unexpected. We had been awarded in 2002, the Arizona Parents of the Year, and a lot of that was based on our work with our neighborhood band, with all the children and families in our neighborhood. And then we were entered into the national event, and we were one of three of the National Excellence in Parenting, and they took us to Washington, D.C., and to the Capitol and all of that, and it was extremely exciting and very lovely, very lovely.
Well, thank you, Jill.
Well, thank you.
I'll see you in a minute or two.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Annie, before we continue with the interview, I want to make a few comments.
Okay.
For those who are listening. First of all, folks, you have to understand that Vincent is 82 years old and suffering from older people-type illnesses. He's a little exhausted right now and so cannot continue the interview. His lovely wife, Annie, is helping us get some information about what had occurred to Vincent. And why am I so interested in Vincent C. Price? Why would a talk show host be interested? First of all, let me tell you that while the gentleman may have difficulty in speaking right now, he's a rather amazing individual. Try it yourself, folks. Think of growing up as a poor black child in Jamaica. No money, limited food, or a rather harsh disciplinarian for a mom, and now you're going to make your way in life. You think you can do it? Most of us couldn't, believe me. Most of us are not made that way. People like Mr. Beach are a rare breed. And that's why I wanted this book presented. Because what I'm telling you, folks, is if you could pick up his enthusiasm for life, for his future as he saw it, and continue on in the face of adversity, which is now where I want to bring Annie in. Annie, this man had to face a lot of problems, especially because he was black. What happened to him in terms of racism and bigotry?
Well, it happened in the United States, unfortunately.
Go ahead and tell us what happened when he got to the United States and what he encountered in the way of racism.
Okay. In the United States, he went almost directly to Indianapolis to go to school. He had gotten a sponsor there finally after a couple of years of trying to find somebody who would sponsor him back there in 1952. And he went to school. He, of course, could only work in certain places. And the story I remember the best that's in the book was when he went to a really nice department store and he wanted to work and be a salesperson. And they said, no, we don't have Negroes out there. They work in the back and do the stocking. And they even had to wear a shirt and a tie, and they had to eat in their own little lunchroom. And that kind of thing he had never encountered before. And another incident that really just slayed him, and he made up his mind to return to England at that point. He did. He made a trip back again, and then he eventually got himself together and came back. But he had won a sweepstakes on the radio station for some
lessons
at Arthur Murray at dance studio. And when he went down to claim his prize, they informed him that, Negroes weren't eligible. They couldn't be dancing with white people. And he tried to argue, well, you didn't say that. And they said, it's just understood. And that was many incidents like that.
Was it the racism he encountered that pushed him to leave the United States?
Yes. Yes. Without doubt. Because he felt he couldn't go here, he couldn't go there. He was not used to having to do that. The people who lived there, though, the black folks around him could not understand his attitude. They said, that's just the way it is. You just get along. And he couldn't do it. But when he went back to England, the opportunity was so really poor, he realized that he had let his dream slip away. And he came back again. And at that point was when he, with no work and realizing he had to do a whole lot more to get to be a big-name musician, he had the opportunity to join the United States Air Force.
So he did join the U.S. Air Force.
Yes, he did. In, I believe, 1957, 56, maybe 55. And he stayed for 22 years.
What did he do in the U.S. Air Force?
Well, the best part was when he finished boot camp, they were going to send him to tech school in mechanic stuff. And he just said, I want to be in the band. And they auditioned him, and he made it. And that's what he did for 22 years all over the world. He was in the United States Air Force.
Oh, so he spent 22 years playing in the band for the Air Force. That had to be a wonderful
experience. Yep, the United States Air Force. And he got out, retired in 1977, and by that time, he'd entered into education, trying to figure out what he was going to do when he got out, and he ended up...
All right, hold on one second, Annie. This man, now, when he's spending this 22 years in the U.S. Air Force in the band, was he married at the time?
Yes, he was married, not to me. He was married to his first wife from 1956,
which was about the time that he joined the U.S. Air Force.
He had been in about a year or two when he married her.
Were there children from that marriage?
Yes, four wonderful boys.
Okay,
four
now I understand. Wonderful. I understand that. Did he lose one of these children?
Two of them died as. One at 19, he was just home from the U.S. Air Force Academy, and they discovered he had lupus, systemic lupus, they believe. Anyway, he was dead a very short time later. That was in 1983. And then in 1989, his third son died of the same thing. Very tragic. And they were wonderful boys. Now, I personally knew that one. He lived with us.
So there must be some sort of genetic problem then.
They don't think so. No one knows of it anywhere else in the family. And
cases within one family, and they still can't conclude that it's genetic?
I know. Nope. They don't. And it's highly unusual for young men to have it. But it was definitely diagnosed as that. The one boy who died in 1989, Lal, he had had it for a number of years, since he was, say, 10 years old. And so there was always question of what did they really have, or, you know, was the one treated so vigorously that the steroids killed him? Because he died maybe within a month of being diagnosed, probably less than that.
Well, Annie, when did you meet Vincent?
I met him in 1983. He had just been assigned as principal of a little boarding school up on the Navajo Reservation.
Okay,
and
before we get to that, I guess I should ask you, how did he wind up getting involved in education to get to the Navajo Reservation, to get to meet you? How did that occur?
How did he even get there, right? Well, while he was in the Air Force, he decided when he got out and he had a big family, he was going to have to be able to do something. And so with his sixth grade education, he began to work on his GED. He went from that to taking college classes. He got that degree, and then he went on to get his master's degree in counseling psych. And, with an emphasis. I know. That's why it had to be told. It's a guy who worked day and night, day and night, day and night to get somewhere because he wanted to provide for his family. That was his whole thing. So when he got out...
You know, Annie, most people today would not have the gumption that Vincent has to follow through. Coming from nothing to what he was able to accomplish, I mean, it's absolutely amazing.
It is. When you say, though, he came from nothing, he came from an economic nothing, but he certainly came from a strong family that, for instance, as poor as they were, they believed in getting the best education, and he did get in the little Catholic school, which did cost some money. His parents both, his mom baked pies and did everything she could, and she made clothes, too, for people. You know, to...
Explain that, Annie. That's a part I don't understand. Did his family actually have to pay for him to go to school?
Yes, public school up to, was it sixth grade? Was free, but it wasn't very good, obviously, at all. And... The Catholic Church was a couple of miles away. And that's what his father and mother, although they weren't Catholic themselves, that's where they put their children, all five of them. And they went to Catholic school so that they felt they would get the best education, but it didn't go beyond sixth grade. So after that, high school was really expensive. And that's why when he said then he was supposed to come up with a trade, you know, his mom wanted him to be a barber, and he didn't want to do that. He finally went to work an apprentice. You know how they used to apprentice out. He apprenticed out in a mechanic shop, so he learned to work on old cars. But he didn't see that as his future. He always thought, there's something better for me. And along came World War II, and... You know, guys, they were in there recruiting for England and the Jamaican Army, and he ended up, though, wanting to go in the Royal Air Force.
Well, it was the best thing he could have done. I mean,
absolutely.
It really got him out of Jamaica, and of course, he picks up the clarinet and meets the black community in England, which I'm sure was that really stimulated him into becoming more involved. Okay, when he left the U.S. Air Force, he has to do something for his family. He gets this education. He starts applying for teaching positions. Is that what happened?
Well, he went to Florida, and again, right out of the Air Force, he took them down to Orlando, Florida, and he encountered again the type of racism where. He couldn't buy a house in a nicer neighborhood. He was overqualified for the jobs that he tried for. You know, it became very discouraging. Fortunately, he had applied to civil service, and all of a sudden, here came a letter, and he was sent to Arizona to the Bureau of Indian Affairs to a big boarding school. It's called Toye Boarding School. And so from there, he was a counselor, or actually, they called them counselors, but actually they were administrators in charge of the dormitories in the boarding school. And so from 1977, that's what he did. And then again, and he was pretty old by then. He was he had to be way over 50 years old then, because he's 83 now. But that was in 77.
Okay, well. What happened to his first wife?
Well, they divorced.
Tell me the circumstances.
Give you the circumstances?
Yeah, what caused the divorce? What happened?
It wasn't me, let me tell you that right up front. I came away late.
you weren't the woman in the background. Okay, Annie.
I'm innocent. And he is innocent. He had never done a wrong thing. What he describes in the book and what I know about it, first of all, he married her. He wrote letters and found her in Jamaica. It was a letter writing campaign that's described very beautifully in the book. And they married. She's East Indian, Jamaican, but of East Indian descent, pure East Indian.
Uh-huh.
And just from the beginning, they never really were able to click. Is that a good way to put it? They had four wonderful sons, but it just never clicked, and it became a very untenable situation for him. But he was the kind of person, he just stayed in. And when he got to the reservation, she didn't want to live up there, and so she lived 200 miles down here in the Phoenix area. And that went on for 7 years, and finally she just divorced him.
At this point, did you know him while he was married?
No, not at all. No.
Oh,
when
so
I went
you...
to work, I was placed at his school. I was hired. He didn't even want me because he thought I'd cost too much money on his staff. But I was placed at his school. I was called a home living specialist, and I was in charge of the dormitory, and he took care of the overall school. You know, it's like a whole little community of 40 employees and a whole bunch of children, and they stay there during the week and sometimes weekends. We were up in Kinlochee, which is near, about 50 miles from Gallup, New Mexico. So I was put there.
I know exactly where it is.
Really? Okay.
I spent quite a bit of time around the Four Corners area, and as a matter of fact, Annie, my background is in psychology. I spent 25 years in clinical services, and I spent a lot of time on the Navajo Reservation.
Really?
I have a PhD in psychology, you know, the whole nine yards, and I was working for the Mental Health Center in Monticello, Utah, and I had responsibility for covering the Four Corners area. I'm pretty familiar with, you know, Mexican Hat and all those places down through there. I spent, I think, a little over 2 years floating around that area. I'm very familiar with the sounds, the taste, the smell. You know what? I still miss mutton stew. But tell me, I love that. I really do. And it's not something I can get up here in the northern part of Utah, which, by the way, I'm thinking of moving from, hopefully soon, but I'm not quite sure. Okay, well, how did you and Vincent get together? Let's get to that.
Well, we were the only two supervisors in the school, the little school, way out in the middle of nowhere. And we just worked together, never thought about each other personally at all. I had no idea if he was married or not married. He had no idea about me. We really worked hard day and night with the school. And about 7 months into that, we had a personal conversation one day, and I was telling him something about, you know, I was all on my own, and he divulged that he was on his own and about his boy having died just a few months before in February of 83. And all of a sudden, he ran to the calendar and he asked me, would I like to go golfing in Gallup? And I thought, oh, wow. Well, I haven't ever done that before, but that sounds fun. And so we had walked home every night together. He would stay. And that's what I mean. We just talked about work. We never he was very careful about anything like that. And I just realized, and he realized, hey, here's some cool person. And that's how it happened. And we secretly got married because otherwise they would have made me move. And indeed, as soon as they found out, about 4 months later, I had to get a counseling job with Ganado Public Schools. They wouldn't let me stay.
Why? I don't understand that.
Our story. Yeah. And then when he retired from there in 1986, we came down to Chandler area and began a whole new life here. And with the Williams Air Force Base, we worked there. And he began to teach community college. That was his dream. He wanted to be a community college teacher, and so he did for 13 years. He taught psychology. He taught political science, the Arizona Constitution, you know, the U.S. Constitution, that kind of thing. So he did all of that. And the thing about him that you can't maybe hear now, he's this wonderful, humble, soft-spoken, he always has been soft-spoken person that just, he attracts people just because of that.
I want to ask you a question, Annie, regarding the book. First of all, if somebody wants to purchase a book, how can they get it?
Okay. There's several ways. Not through an 800 number. I was hoping to give you that, but the publisher doesn't have that. It's on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, Walmart.com, or you can go to the publisher has his website. It's www.vincentbeach.com, and the book can be purchased through the publisher that way. And really, any bookstore can be ordered because it's doing very well.
Give the title again, Annie.
Pardon?
Give the title of the book again.
Oh, Don't Throw Away Your Stick Till You Cross the River. And the subtitle, The Journey of an Ordinary Man. But if you just Google Vincent Beach.
I understand that he has a couple of book tours coming up. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, we go to a lot of book signings. For instance, the next one will be at the Big Parkinson's Conference here in Phoenix on November 10th. And then he'll be at the Singing Wind Bookshop, which is kind of a famous Southwestern bookshop down in Benson, Arizona, on November 7th. You know, things like that. We're going out to Fort McDowell Indian Reservation this week for a book presentation on writing your story.
I have a question here from my wife. She wants to know about the bunkhouse in Chandon, California. Apparently that's where you wrote most of the book. And she's curious as to why did you and your husband decide to write the book in California?
Okay, we have all kinds of pets and animals, and we live in, you know, the neighborhood where the musicians are here all the time, young children and everything, and I knew that we could never get this done in the atmosphere here because it was too busy. And so, we had to be quiet for a while, and he had recovered he had a terrible illness, like out of nowhere, called endocarditis. And then from there, the Parkinson's thing kicked in, and it was like, we have to get this done. You know, we had been thinking about it. I had especially, because I wanted his story down. I knew it was wonderful, all the different things. And I had been recording him, you know, and we'd travel somewhere, and I'd ask him questions, and I was recording it.
We have another call.
Okay.
Annie, we have a call. Hold on for a second. Caller?
Yes.
What is your name, please?
Tony.
Tony!
Yes.
And Tony, do you have a question for Annie?
Yes, I do. I was just wondering if religion played any part in Vincent's life during his entire lifetime. And if it did, what part did it play?
Well, it most certainly did. but I'll let Annie address that. Annie, would you address Tony's question?
Yes, yes. He has a wonderful spirituality. We were listening to you today, Nevin, on your web thing. And it was interesting because about the organized spirituality, he's always belonged to the Catholic Church, but he goes far beyond that. In the book, he addresses that there is a higher power, and he is able to submit to that, and that he feels that prayer is just an ongoing thing in his life. He doesn't stop and do it somewhere or anything like that. It's part of who he is. Does that answer your question, Tony?
Yeah, in a way. And I was also wondering, how does Vincent feel now in these days, as far as we know that what the black man went through years ago? How does he feel? Have we progressed quite a bit in his mind, or are we still striving for to get the equality between the races?
I can answer that for him, I think. Things are a whole lot better than they ever were. But we have a long way to go in not just equality, but in people actually interacting on all levels with each other, with all kinds of people. And like in our little band here, it is a rainbow. It's all different kinds of people, Russians and Native Americans and everybody, all kinds of children and families. And children are able to get to know each other and grow up together, you know, playing music because they have a common thing. And it's wonderful to see it. In many places you don't see that. Same with our church. There's all kinds of people, and we believe and we try to promote that people need to interact with each other in order to...
Well, listen, folks, I don't want to interrupt, but we're kind of running out of time. Tony, I want to thank you for your phone call.
Okay,
and,
thank you for taking it.
I know you're an avid listener of Woodland Star. And listen,
sure,
folks, this is my brother-in-law on the phone, a wonderful man. And
let me say one thing.
He does have an interest in people. Listen, I have to say goodbye to you, Tony.
Okay.
I need to wrap up the show with Andy, okay?
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye. Andy, I have a burning question that has nothing to do with the book.
Okay.
Are you ready for it?
Yes.
Vincent, to me, bears a striking resemblance to Morgan Freeman. Am I the first person to ever say that?
People say that. They do say that a lot. Isn't that funny? Yes, they do say that.
Well, I mean, if you look at the picture on the front of his book, I feel like I'm looking at Morgan Freeman. It's kind of like, could these two men be related? And what I did was I went on the net and found a picture of Morgan Freeman and put it next to Vincent's picture, and I'm telling you, they look like brothers.
Okay, tell me.
You might try it yourself and go grab a picture off the net. Annie, we are really. It was a fascinating interview. I'm sorry we are out of time. And please give my best to Vincent. He has a wonderful story to tell and to share. I just wish I could go to some of those bluegrass music sessions with you. So, you have a wonderful day, okay, Annie?
Thank you so much. Let him say goodbye to you.
Goodbye. All right, put him on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Goodbye.
Okay, goodbye, Vincent. You have a wonderful evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks
so okay.
much. We loved it. Okay, take care.
Well, folks, I know full well that listening at some point could have been a little bit difficult with this particular show. You know what? It's okay. Because what we had on the show was the real deal. We had a real live human who is now, 83 years old, and he's still able to get on the air. Can you imagine that? You try it when you're 83 and go through the life that gentleman went through. That's the end of today's show. Well, you know, I did mention that I'm thinking of moving, and I'm hopeful of getting some type of closure on that very soon. Well, thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful day. See you next week on Woodland Star. Darn, that's a wrap.